Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders in sustainable and impact investment, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness and highlight best practices in order to help us transition more capital into the industry faster. I am JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners, and we are the proud sponsors of the podcast. ILM Partners is an advisory and soon-to-launch multi-asset management firm targeting to acquire and scale investment funds focused on sustainability and impact. Our mission is to facilitate and accelerate the transition of £5 billion of capital to sustainable impact investing in the next 5 years. If you would like to explore the opportunity of working together, email contact@ilaandpartners.com for an introductory and confidential conversation. Your support means everything to us, since it's what really keeps us going. So make sure you share our work with someone that will benefit from it. Please remember to subscribe to get the notifications and check the notes from each episode. We hope you enjoy today's special conversation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Impact Leaders. I hope everyone is very well, keeping healthy and safe, just making the most of what we can. Today, we have a new episode of Impact Leaders on our current series called The Sustainable Investment Dilemma, which will also be the name of my upcoming book. I think I made a decision on that one, you know, unless you guys want to send me some messages with ideas. But this series and the podcast, as you know, we're looking into how industries can help address the climate and social crisis, in particular, the financial industry, taking on the opportunity to find and fund the solutions we need for a sustainable future. And in order always to do that, you know, we bring some amazing guests. Today we have one more special guest for you, dear listeners, who is David O'Leary. Hello and welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, JP. Excited to have this conversation.
Very, very nice. Me too. We have known each other, you know, maybe not for that long, but it feels like we know each other for much longer.
For sure.
And then I always ask this question just so that everyone knows. So where are you today, David?
I'm in Toronto, Canada. I'm based in Toronto, but I'm actually a couple hours north in a ski area called Blue Mountain, which I think by European standards would be kind of laughed at because it's a pretty small mountain. By mountain standards, it's pretty small, but in Ontario, Canada, it's the best we got.
Right. Do you happen to know how high it is?
I can't even imagine it's like, you know, a couple thousand feet, not that type of ballpark, very small. Most people would probably call it a big hill.
Yeah, you know, just wondering, you know, because I started doing my first trekking. I did my first mountain that day, but it was 1,085 meters, right? Which I always struggle to translate to feet. But I'm kind of getting a better idea what height means, you know, because of how hard it is to climb it. But anyway,
I did just look it up. It's 1,400 feet. So I had a good guess.
Very good, very good. And it's another first. Definitely would have been from Canada, I guess, and from Toronto, and from Blue Mountain. So it's a triple one, right? But thank you for being with us today. And given your background, as people will learn, we will be focusing on some real wealth management, including, you know, values and line investment actions, as I thought about it. And as I was preparing. So I'm very excited, David, to have you with us to discuss potentially some of your values, you know, some of your drivers I thought about, you know, your lessons and suggestions, especially for investors, and how perhaps, you know, the market is evolving to impact people's lives, you know, how it touches, I was thinking, the financial provision to provide for our lives, right? So wealth management is so, so important beyond those that have wealth, which is another point that I want to discuss with you. So very, very, I think we have quite a few interesting subjects, you know, unless, you know, there's something in your mind that you want to, that you thought about that we should definitely cover.
No, that all sounds great. And I'm happy to kind of bring up if other thoughts come to me, but that sounds like a great topic.
So let me quickly introduce you, just a short bio for people's background, if you haven't met David before. So David O'Leary is a wealth management expert, impact investment professional, public speaker, and writer. David spends his time as founder and principal of Kind Wealth, a holistic wealth management practice helping early to mid-career Canadians manage their money in a way that matches their values. In addition to hosting two podcasts, the Kind Wealth podcast and the Impact Investing podcast, David is a frequent speaker at conferences and in the media, including The Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, National Post, BNN Bloomberg, even CNBC Africa, to name a few. And he holds a variety of professional designations, including the Chartered Financial Analyst, CFA, and the Qualified Associate Financial Planner, which is the QAFP. And I think I recall seeing that you're also studying for a couple more, maybe specific to impact, right? So perhaps we can talk about that when we talk about measurement.
Sure.
And there is a lot more, but I'm going to save some for the last part, which is on the personal side. You know, it's a fantastic story, that life story as well that David has. But let me start with the first question that we ask all our guests, David, which is, what is sustainable and impact investing for you?
Yeah, so for me, there are two, I would classify them separately. So sustainable investing for me would be thinking about, as we're making investments, thinking about the impact that those investments have on people and the planet, and that the investments that we make, what we should be expecting of them is that they aren't, you know, destroying our planet and or making life worse for people. And so the way I like to equate it is, you know, I think we've been investing now for a long, long time in a way that had zero regard for the impact that those investments were having on others around us. It would be like we were walking down the street, littering as we go, without any regard for, you know, the dirt and the pollution and mess we were creating around us. As if you walked into somebody's house and had no regard for whether you kept, you know, you took your shoes off, whether you're dropping food along the way, making a mess through your guest's home. And that's how we've been investing. And so the sustainable investing is just like a recognition that, oh, right, when we make an investment, that has an impact on others around us. And we should be mindful about, you know, is that sustainable? Are we going to, you know, if we continue this at scale for a long period of time, is it creating big problems for us as a, for people or the planet? And impact investing, I think about as sort of a further step along that continuum, which says that not only do we want to sort of minimize and make sure it's sustainable, we're not, you know, hurting anybody, how do we make a positive impact and solve problems with our capital? And we can kind of get into and unpacking that, but it has a fairly rigid and, you know, very strict kind of definition. I think I'm a proponent of maintaining a strict definition of impact investing and what does it mean to have a positive impact? And we can unpack all that if you want, but that's how I think about them, sort of do no harm versus making a positive impact.
Okay, I like it. But please, enlighten me. How would you unpack it? Because let me say something. So as I've learned more and more, and that's why I started talking about sustainable impact investing to bring the full spectrum of capital I always talk about. But I really appreciate there is what I call sometimes, you know, a Puritan view. Sometimes I talk about a hardcore, sometimes I talk about like a real impact investing part, you know, as I meet what I call the people that are, you know, really on the ground delivering and helping, especially people, the social impact side, and then obviously the environmental side. So I'm curious, you know, to hear what you're coming from and what you're thinking about unpacking.
Yeah. And I know you see that full spectrum. And I mean, I see the other guests you have, and I know, you know, the conversations we're in together, you see that whole spectrum. So I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know here, but for those listening, yeah, I mean, I think, so a few things. I think we need to be welcoming of everybody into the space and try to, and I think that you do a really good job of that, which is let's meet people where they are and bring them into the conversation. Let's not get to, you know, oh, well, we do it the real way and other people don't. So I'm also of that mindset. We don't want to alienate folks and make them feel like they're not up to, you know, up to par. And so theirs doesn't count. But on the other hand, I think we do need to maintain some, you know, definitions and terminology. And it's one of the problems in the industry is that it's a young industry and it's nascent. And a lot of the terminology, you know, we haven't coalesced around certain terms and definitions, and that's starting to happen. But so on impact investing, I would say that at a minimum, if you are going to claim to be an impact investor, that you should have a theory of change. So, I mean, the textbook definition would say there are two key criteria for an impact investor. One is that you have an intentional change you're trying to bring about. So it's not happening by accident, and it's measurable. And so coming back to this theory of change term, which I just dropped a moment ago, a theory of change is essentially a theory for how what you're doing in the world is going to make the world a better place. A logical framework for if I do this, then this should happen, then that should happen. And you can sort of draw a straight line or sometimes a curvy line from, you know, my investment to some sort of positive impact. And it just shows you've taken the time to think about how what you're doing can make a positive impact. And then you go about measuring that over time. Now, we can go deep into the weeds on how you go about measuring that. Is that framework sound? Or have you thought about all the variables? How are you measuring and managing it over time? But at a minimum, if you haven't even gone to the trouble of thinking about, you know, the logical framework for how what you're doing is making a positive impact on the world, if you're claiming to be an impact investor, then I think your claims to be an impact investor are questionable. And I, by the way, I don't know that there's anything wrong with that. I don't think everybody tomorrow has to be an impact investor. At a, you know, but you may just be a sustainable investor, or you may just be a socially responsible or conscious investor. And that's okay too. I would love for us to have more and more people doing meaningful impact investing. So this is not about pushing people away, but I think we do want to maintain some definitions and some clarity on terms.
Yeah. No, but I really value and appreciate you mentioned interesting enough theory of change. It's almost like it's meant to be, I think, because I haven't talked about it, I think, too much, if not at all, before. And it's very, very relevant to what we're doing in the past weeks as I brought it up, you know. So let me give you a bit of context, and I take an opportunity to share some news as well. So we started working with FinTech in LATAM, and you know, it's a company that's looking to effectively the problem, and just so that people understand, and we'll put some links on theory of change and how to look at it. But like you said, you know, you had to look at the problem, you had to kind of speak about the theme that you're trying to cover slash, you know, address with this problem, and then kind of how you think they're going to change, you know, and you're going to affect that problem, i.e. solve it, right? So, but what really caught my attention is that as we were discussing with the people in the company and also with some of the senior advisors that we have in ILM Partners, that still a lot of people don't know about it, David. It's fascinating that, you know, although people are into, you know, head of sustainability at different wealth management firms or big investment management firms, or they're still on ESG. So I thought it was fascinating as I, you know, talked about it, brought it up, that people didn't know the concept, let alone how to use it. So I'll give an example so that people understand. In this case, the way that we looked at it for this fintech, which, by the way, again, just for context so that people understand, in Latin America, there is, I think it's 270 million people that are basically unbanked, right? Of which, so it's like 49% of the over 50 years old, you know, don't have even access to financial services. And then if you go into credit, it goes as low as, you know, in some countries, like only 10%, which is crazy, right? So the problem is, in this kind of theory of change, is, you know, unbanked, you know, the unbanked urban and rural poor, let's call it, all of these people, which, you know, you can define how they are. What you're trying to change is basically offering impactful services or innovative solutions, which ultimately will fight poverty if we believe in, you know, a kind of impact economics, right? But then there is the other part about the theory of change, which is around offering fair prices, because the poor tend to pay much more than the wealthy for products and services, right? Because they don't have that, they have the cost associated to the transactions are much higher. If you measure it mathematically, let alone in time, sometimes to have to travel from a town to another just to exchange. And I'll talk about it, but I know that you lived in South Africa, so you also have had experience, you know, or you know what I'm talking about, right? In terms of, you know, how the other half, inverted commas, sometimes leaves, right? Or not sometimes, it does. Anyway, so I thought I just dropped that so that people understand, you know, the problem, the change, and then the solution. In this case, you do it through fintech, right? Through a digital solution, which is easy to access to everyone, especially now that everyone's got a phone. So I hope that people enjoyed that example. I thought I just, it was so relevant, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. 100%. That's a really, really relevant example. And so as you think about, you know, what are the positive benefits that come from having access to financial services and solutions that we here probably take in the developed world, take for granted, like, you know, a loan or a credit card, an insurance, you know, product, just a bank account somewhere you can go in a place that you can safely trust that you can put your money and not worry about getting access to it whenever you mm-hmm. want to. Those are things that, you know, a good percentage of the world and the folks you're talking about in South America and all over Sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, like there's folks all over the world who don't have those basic services. And so then what problems does that create? If we tackle those problems, you know, what kind of benefits come from that? And so that's what a theory of change would say. It would just look at, okay, so if we do this, then that happens. And so, you know, what you find is that often what we find is the problems are complex. When you actually go to the trouble of thinking through the logical framework, you realize, oh, right. So if we just providing this service may not be enough. So for instance, oh, hey, we have a digital technology that allow people to store money and put it into a bank account. So it's convenient. Doesn't matter the distance between towns and where the nearest bank is. I'm just using it, for instance, a pretty simplified example. What you may find throughout that process is, great, we've introduced this, but we can't get any uptake. Well, you may not be getting any uptake because the people in these environments may not trust the institutions around them to give them money. What do you mean? I'm gonna hand over this precious savings that I have to some institution in a country where I'm used to them not, you know, being able to promise and deliver, and there's no geopolitical stability. You know, governments are potentially being toppled, and you know, so people put things under a mattress because they don't want to see it leave their sight. So you could see if you went through the trouble of going through the framework, oh, right, we've got another issue. We've got a trust issue we got to get around, which we take for granted in the developed world.
Sadly, by the way, very relevant today to South Africa with everything that is going down there, right? So my prayers go to them, you know, talking about civil unrest and some of the things that happen mm-hmm. in some of the countries. It's just unbelievable. But and this is interesting because as I think about wealth management, you know, this is, and we can get into a definition of what is wealth and wealth management, and, you know, but for these people, that is the little they have is their inverted commas wealth. And then the way that you touch, you know, trust brings me to this question, which I had to ask you around all things investing. Let's talk fiduciary duty, right? So what is it? Kind of question, because again, we're going to talk definition and how does it really fit, you know, on sustainable and impact investing, you know, mm-hmm. because there's a conversation that's really happening, supposedly. Again, I challenge anyone in the industry.
Yeah, it's a really great question, JP. So fiduciary duty says that if you are managing somebody's, in the context of the asset management industry, if you're managing somebody's assets, that you have a duty to treat that pool of assets as if, you know, it were your own, or essentially put your client's interests ahead of yours, so that, you know, if there comes a point where you're giving them advice and, hey, if I give them this piece of advice, it'll be better for me and maybe not as good for them because I'm going to make a better, you know, fee mm-hmm. off of that investment, or I'll get some sort of kickback somewhere along the way, but it may not be as good for the client. That's a huge no-no in the investment industry. And you'd be breaking, you know, underpins our obligations. It'd be kind of the equivalent of the Hippocratic Oath mm. that a doctor mm. might take. And so it becomes very relevant in the sustainable investment landscape. And it has been what I think has been a big hitch or hurdle for the sustainable and impact investment movement. For it held that back from taking hold sooner and faster, because what you had were a finance and investment industry globally that was underpinned by this idea that is kind of Milton Friedman. And Milton Friedman was a popular economist mm-hmm. who is very famous for arguing that a business's sole obligation is to make a profit, and the whole social environmental responsibility should not be factored in. And he made, you know, his argument for why that was. And that underpinned all of finance, which is that our goal here is to just maximize our shareholder value. And so what they said was, you know, this sustainable and environmental impact stuff and this is interesting, but you know, an investment, big institutional investment manager is running a pension for, you know, government employees would say, well, hey, I may want to do this positive stuff, but my obligation is to get the best return I can. And what underpins that argument is, oh, if I am going to invest sustainably or with positive impact, I have to sacrifice return. And so I can't do that because I have an obligation to just do the best. I don't know that my clients care about this stuff, you know, the people whose assets I'm managing. So I just have to. And the flaw with that argument is that it assumes that if you're going to, you know, take into account these, you know, if you're going to invest sustainably, that you're going to sacrifice return. And I think what we're finding, and there's still debate being had in academic circles about this, is so the data is bearing out that over the past 15, 20 years, sustainable stocks and bonds have outperformed those that we might call them brown stocks, you know, so those that aren't healthy or having a negative impact. And so the argument is, so the data is bearing out that certainly you don't have to give up return. I think some people would argue, and we don't have to talk about this, so we don't want to, but we, you know, some people would argue that we're going through a period of time where they will outperform, but that will end. And then, you know, you shouldn't actually receive a higher return to invest in sustainable stocks and bonds. And again, that's another argument, but that's what's been holding it back, is I have to get the best return for my client. If I'm going to invest sustainably, it's going to lower my return, so I won't do it. And it held, you know, institutional money, where most of the money, the assets, you know, these days are being managed is by large institutions. Mm. It held them back from investing sustainably. And now what's happening, I think, is there's a recognition and realization that, oh, right, these aren't mutually exclusive. I can invest in a way that's sustainable and still generate a positive return. So that's starting to change.
Yeah. And I would maybe, something that comes to my mind is that, again, dilemma, right? Which is, I'm trying to do this for the benefit of my clients, but because ultimately, for, you know, people listening and people know about this, but, you know, to just state the obvious, you know, as you do wealth management and manage investments and assets, you're trying to, in specific terms, you know, provide for the livelihood of people, especially, you know, in developed countries as they retire, you know, with their pensions. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, generationally, as you know, they pass on the wealth and, you know, that money to their children, etc. But the flaw is that if there is nowhere to live and where to spend the money, it's a very short term view. And I talk about this in various forums, but, you know, I think that we don't discuss enough. Definitely, I think we haven't discussed it enough in the podcast. And then on the other side, the fact that the fallacy or again the dilemma that if I am managing your money, I'm charging you fees, I am rewarded by your returns and by the growth of my business, right? So if there is any doubt that whatever I'm going to do is going to, and also thirdly, my rewards as a manager, as a CEO, as a, you know, somebody running the business, right? So if you think that you're going to do less return, obviously it's very quickly and very easy to say that, well, actually I need to look after the fiduciary duty, which is, you know, to look after my investors, my clients, you know, which is defined, going full circle to, you know, Friedman's view that it should be just money and not anything else, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the problems with that argument is what you raised at the beginning there, which is, it's a very, we know that humans are myopic, right? Like we care disproportionately about what happens in the immediate term and underweight and aren't very good at kind of thinking about, you know, what the longer term and planning for that. And a lot of these big risks that I think sustainable investing is trying to mitigate are what are called kind of big systemic risks to the entire system. They're not, in finance terms, they're not idiosyncratic risk is the term we would use, which are the types of risks that you take when you invest that you can diversify away. So you know, the risk that a business commits fraud, or, you know, is mismanaged or something like that. Well, I mitigate that risk by owning a whole bunch of different businesses. And so I can control that and I can, you know, structure my portfolio in a way to try to reduce those risks. And that's what investment managers are used to, is this idea that I got to control what I can and the rest of it, these big systemic issues, I can't control those things. So I don't factor them in. They're called externalities. I remove them because it makes my job easier to simplify my decision making. And what the problem with that is that these big systemic issues are problems that, you know, will manifest over a long period of time that could have huge impact on our investment dollars. Like, you know, climate change. If we've got, you know, massive damage to the climate and we can't sustain life on Earth, well, nothing's going to survive. Or social unrest because of wealth inequality is so large that governments get toppled and, you know, potentially, you know, overthrowing even capitalism itself, right? If people get fed up enough with it and don't believe that it's working for doing a good job of distributing opportunity and wealth, you could revert back to sort of communist type of governments. And that may sound, you know, kind of far-fetched, but history is littered with examples, right? Of unrest creating that kind of instability and change. And so if we don't try to mitigate those risks, as long-term as they may be, we're increasing the risk to the entire market. Like just investing and going about our daily lives is growing risk with that, with climate change, with wealth inequality. And there's a number of these big systemic risks. And we need investment managers to start thinking about those. Like we are all contributing to those, especially the big institutional money managers that control the vast majority of the world's wealth. They have a disproportionate impact on these big systemic issues. And so I think we all need to just recognize, even if it were the case that we have to sacrifice some returns, what's the alternative? What, that we risk that we can no longer survive on our planet? I mean, I don't know why this is even a question. Why would we take that risk? Why are we playing that game? I think the problem is we have this prisoner's dilemma, which is I may be doing something positive, but somebody else isn't. And they may be profiting off of the fact that if there is a profitable opportunity to act irresponsibly, that they're going to benefit from that. I don't know that that's actually true in long term, but you know, that's the perception. And if that's the perception, you get people not wanting to act. Well, this person's not going to act responsibly and they're going to benefit from that. So I don't want to bother. If not everybody's going to do it, I won't do it either. You know, so that's the mentality I think that can happen sometimes.
And to that effect, I must highlight, and I think we've spoke about it more specifically to some of the products and some of the investments that we speak about on the podcast, but again across the spectrum, but there is legislation coming in, right, which is trying to basically now asking people to report more and more on the corporate side, on the management, investment management side, which is trying to in a way put a mirror to this fiduciary duty, I would say. I think that when I listen to all the experts and the different kind of regulatory bodies, they don't speak to it like that. But the way I read it, you know, many times, because we're speaking about it as well now, I think it's like your fiduciary duty is exposed. You know, if you are now reporting on, you know, how you are following, in our case, you know, the EU taxonomy, you know, your emissions, and not just ESG, right? So it's going beyond ESG, as I always talk about. So it's becoming more and more interesting, and I commend. I never had the chance, but I commend Canada, because Canada is also, you know, between Europe and if people look at the GSIA report, you know, I think it's Europe, Canada, Australia, Japan, of course, that are kind of, you know, leading the pack, right, in terms of behaviors.
I wish we were doing more. I think Europe is clearly the kind of clear and away leader here. I agree. I mean, Canada on the, you know, on the global scale, it would rank on the higher end, but I wish we were doing even more than we are. And so things like, you know, the regulatory requirements, the regulators in particular in the UK are very progressive, and have done some really groundbreaking stuff just across the board, not even just related to sustainability, but in the investment markets, which I follow. The regulators there have really gone to task on things like removing conflicts of interest, increasing transparency around pricing in the investment management landscape, and now sustainability-related disclosures from companies requiring that, and requiring asset managers to be considering this stuff, which is wonderful. I think that's what we do need policy to mandate some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. So and on that point, then maybe let's move on to the next part, which I wanted to talk about, which is, you know, in kind of, you said, I wish we were doing more, but, you know, I always tell people we have to do what we can, you know, in our path, in our field, mm-hmm. right? And I see you, David, as one of those people, and therefore, obviously, that's why I wanted to have this conversation and share with others. And because you had a company, I picked up, you know, on your website. So the company, David is the founder of Kind Wealth, as I mentioned before. That's kindwealth.ca. And it's, as I read, you know, your website, there's one part which says that our entire business exists for a social purpose to empower all Canadians, and not just the wealthy few, to take control of their money so that they can live kind of life on their own terms, right? So I picked that one up. And people should go to the website just to see David's picture when he was very, very, very young. I'm actually going to use that one for, I think, for the podcast, social media post. tell us more about, you know, Kind Wealth and about what you guys do or what you're doing.
Yeah, sure. So Kind Wealth is a work in progress. We're what I like it to be in the long term, you know, still got a ways to go. But what we do is we work with kind of next generation Canadians. So I think about it as 30 to kind of 50 year olds, a segment of the market that historically has been underserved by the financial advisors in terms of receiving, you know, meaningful quality financial advice. And the reason they're underserved is because they typically don't have the size of investment portfolio that allows an advisor to make a healthy profit off of that client. The way that most financial advisors work is that they charge a percentage of their client's investment assets as a fee. So it might be 1%, let's say, and they collect that. So the bigger the portfolio the client has, the more they, you know, want to roll out the red carpet and work with those people. And so younger folks just haven't had the same amount of time to grow their investment portfolios. They're more likely to have kids, to have daycare bills, to have a mortgage, things like that, that, you know, and that's just the typical, you know, life cycle of a individual's wealth. It starts off and we're in debt. We get out of school and we start earning money and we pay, you know, we get in more debt with buying a home and then we pay that all off. And then later in our career, when our earnings are at the peak, you know, we paid off our debts, our kids are now moving out of the house and our wealth is growing, you know, pretty dramatically until we retire and then draw it down till we pass away. So, what we're trying to do is address that problem, which is this: the way that advisors price their services mean they're going to exclude the vast majority of the, you know, the population from receiving financial advice systematically, right? By the very nature of how we structured the industry. And what's frustrating in the industry is that advisors sort of throw their hands up and say, well, you know, what can be done? You know, I need to make a profit. So we set up Kind Wealth with a different pricing model to try to tackle that issue. And we set it up on a flat fee basis. So there's two things that are happening. We have separated. So what financial advisors do is they provide two different services that get conflated. And most people don't realize that that's happening. So there's the two services are investment management and financial planning. And I'll just break down what those are quickly. Investment management is, hey, advisor, I have a bunch of money saved up. I want to invest it to grow my assets, to, you know, grow my wealth. What should I invest in? And that process of figuring out what specific investments you should make with the money you've saved up is a, you know, very involved process. There's, you know, my background comes from that side of the equation, the investment management world. You do things called the CFA, and there's all sorts of certifications, and it's a very robust industry. And then the financial planning is essentially, the very short explanation is it's every other question you have about your money. which would be things like, when can I retire? How much money do I need to have saved up in order to retire? How can I reduce my tax bill? Do I need life insurance? What happens to my money after I die? All these types of questions we might have. If I'm leaving my employer, what should I do with my pension? What options do I have? There's a million and one questions you might have about your money. And so that has an entirely different body of knowledge, certifications that go with that. There's a designation called the Certified Financial Planner designation, which is the gold standard for that body of knowledge. And they get conflated because advisors will tend to charge one price, 1% of your assets, and then they provide both of those services. But what happens is they don't often end up providing much financial planning because they're not explicitly paid for it. As soon as you make an investment, they take their 1% fee or whatever their fee is. They're not paid anymore to give you financial planning. And so that's part of the problem. So we've actually disaggregated those two services and we've charged flat prices for financial planning, which means you'd come in with us and pay a monthly fee, like a subscription. Imagine it like that. We call it a retainer, which means you're paying us a monthly fee as long as you want us to continue working with us. And it doesn't matter how much you have in assets. We're going to charge you a fee that based on how complex your circumstances are and how much time and effort you need from us. And so by separating those things and creating it, you know, it provides a lot more transparency. You know exactly what you're paying, and it removes a conflict of interest, which is whatever we recommend you to do, we don't care. It won't affect what we get paid. Whereas when you take a percentage of investment dollars as your fee, as an advisor, you have an interest in telling that client to invest more money and not, you know, and oftentimes investing is a good thing to do. But if you wanted to buy a piece of real estate, you wanted to donate money, you wanted to pay down debt, those are all things that won't get an advisor paid more money. They'll actually get paid less because you may be withdrawing from your investments to buy your home. You may be withdrawing from your investments to donate or to pay down debt. And the advisor is literally going to make less money if you end up doing that. And so it creates a conflict of interest, actually. Mm. So we've disaggregated, separated those, and we charge flat fees. Sorry for the long-winded ramble. But
no, but I like it because basically you covered about three questions I had.
Okay.
Because, you know, again, just to recap, you know, you cover the point I was going to ask you about, because I noticed that you had the separation of the services. So that you know, covered that point, and it was, thank you for the explanation, because then people can understand. And within financial planning, you know, I talk even in my book I wrote about financial intelligence. So almost like financial intelligence is in David O'Leary at Kind Wealth, because you have done the, you know, certification, etc., to understand how the whole thing works. Where most people don't do the certification, so they don't understand it. They just understand going to work, making some money, and then, you know, I'm supposed to, you know, follow the cycle of life, which is, you explain, you know, in terms of buying, selling, you know, house, children, etc. You know, if you're lucky, blessed, you know, to have all of that. So it's very, very interesting, a very good point. And the flat fee, I was going to ask you about the pricing, you know, and the point that you have this phrase, which is, you know, you are committed to radical truth and transparency, which I love. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very, I think it just, when I read it, it just Ray Dalio came to my mind, you know. But with principles.
That's where I got the radical from.
Yeah, with the principles, sure. But you just felt, you know,
yeah,
you have this one way to you live this, your values is through this pricing model. So thank you for that. Very, very, very good, very good. And then I was going to ask you as well about your ideal clients. Which you cover, you know, in terms of kind of the people that you're working with. So is this is the if you had to draw again around the and you cover mainly Toronto area or is your vision is to expand across Canada? Yeah,
we operate across Canada. Yeah, I also provide some, you know, we also provide some investment consulting, which we don't manage our client assets, but we will help them figure out how to take their portfolio and invest it responsibly or for positive impact. And that I tend to work with just because of the nature of the time and energy that takes and the cost. Again, we don't take an ongoing fee. We take a lump sum single fee, but it's we tend to work with higher net worth individuals there where they've got a bigger portfolio, and what they're going to pay us to help them with it isn't such a big percentage of their portfolio that they can afford it, A. And B, when they make those changes, it has a big impact because they have a meaningful, you know, portfolio. So we'll do that type of work for individuals as well. So it's the financial planning and the investment consulting separately.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have, you know, we talked about your change, and, you know, do you have a way to measure what you're trying to achieve in terms of, I wonder, you know, because I was looking at the website and then I thought, you know, and just because you brought it up, you know, I thought I'd just check.
Great question. Love it. So I do, and it's a work in progress. So the Said School of Business at Oxford has a, you know, really great business school there. And I had a group from the MBA program of students who are, you know, studying there right now. They take on kind of these co-op projects while they're going through school to work on. So I worked with a group of them on coming up with my impact measurement and management framework at Kind Wealth. And so we kind of walked through the theory of change. I would probably end up having a couple different theories of change at Kind Wealth. The one I started with was on the financial planning side. And the idea here is that I want to reach more Canadians with high quality, unbiased financial advice. And so one of the ways we do that is through the pricing framework. One of the other problems, though, that I think exists is that disproportionately those Canadians who aren't kind of in the mass affluent or high net worth category where they receive lots of attention from advisors, disproportionately those who aren't in that group are, you know, women, BIPOC folks, non-binary folks. So, you know, not white men effectively. And so aside from reducing the, like, the price point, so we do flat fee, so it doesn't matter how big your portfolio is, so even those with less wealth, we can still serve. You still have an issue of intersectionality around, you know, their, where they're from, what part of the you know, the country they sit in, and the types of issues they face, the realities in their community. So, you know, if I'm an older white man trying to serve, you know, a 30-year-old, you know, who's, you know, a black woman in the inner city, I might not understand and might not relate very well to that individual. And she might not feel particularly comfortable with me as a financial advisor. And so what I think part of the problem is, aside from just reducing the price point and being creative with how we price our services, is also getting more underrepresented financial planners. Mm-hmm. So, you know, financial planning is dominated by older white men. The average age of an advisor in Canada is something like 58 years old. And it's predominantly men. So how do we get more younger and, you know, BIPOC financial planners so that they can serve? Because advisors tend to serve people who are like them, you know, within plus or minus 5 years of age is typically where most, if you look at an advisor, most of their clients will look fairly similar to them, both geographically, within age range, wealth levels. Like, it's all pretty, you know, because they often, you know, word of mouth spreads, and that's how they track clients, is in their own circles. So if we get more financial planners, we're underrepresented. So we did some work around, A, like, okay, how many, you know, financial planners and advisors are we employing? What are their kind of, are they from underrepresented groups? So specifically looking at that. We also looked at, like, the financial impact, like the impact of, we are entirely virtual operation. We were before the pandemic as well. So what's the kind of carbon footprint reduction from not maintaining physical offices, from not having paperwork, which this industry is really bad for, having tons and tons of it. And then also, like, what positive impact is happening to the Canadians who are receiving financial advice? So do their are our clients, are their savings rates higher than the average Canadian? Are they taking advantage of social, like, certain tax benefits or social security benefits that they're entitled to because they're a new parent, because they are under a certain income level? So things like that. So we were looking at measuring the framework across a variety of different metrics, from the social to the environmental. And then what you have is the challenge of, how do we measure these things in a way that, for a small, you know, for a smaller organization like ours, we don't have the same resources that a large multinational would have. How do we do that in a way that we can actually track those things and report on them over time? And so it's still a work in progress, to be honest with you. And I haven't published a lot on the website because there's still a lot to do in that regard. So we're still working on a dashboard and kind of a way to report that on an ongoing basis. So it's a big challenge.
Yeah, but nice. You know, so two things I would say. So first of all, I was wondering, like, oh, maybe I put you on the spot there, you know, but
no, it's a great question.
So you're really, it's really good to hear that obviously you have been thinking about it, and the fact that you brought it up is for a reason, right? So it's fantastic. And I think you did a couple of words that you mentioned now, I realize, in your website as well, which made me realize that obviously this is all being thought about, you know, obviously you have the access part and the inclusion part. So which really relates to this fintech, which I just mentioned in Latin America, because the benefit that most people and you know, the upper classes, you know, of money get, and then within that, the high, I'm just using other terms, non-financial, the high class, right, of the financial world, they just get such a different service and such a different access, right? And then the pricing, the same again, which is, you know, another issue which you mentioned. Effectively, it's overused perhaps, but it's an inclusion question around not only who you are working with in terms of your employees, but then how that impacts and affects who they're helping, and people relate to people and people trust, you know, people of the same inverted commas kind. So it's fascinating, and it's fascinating. I love it. I love it. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. But as I say, it's a work in progress. So even like, you know, trying to find more underrepresented financial planners is a big challenge, because there aren't a lot of them out there, and there's other bottlenecks to that KindWealth isn't tackling that we need to be able to do that. So for instance, how do we get more, you know, BIPOC youth interested in financial planning as a profession and going through the certification process and all that? Like there are not nearly as many that come through. It's changing, it's getting better, but it's still, you know, way out of whack. So, you know, there's an ecosystem here that KindWealth operates within, which we're limited by to some degree. And so like, this is an ongoing, whenever you're committed to positive impact, as you start to kind of go into the rabbit hole, thinking about a theory of change, and what you start to realize, you realize how deep the rabbit hole goes, how difficult the challenge is. And then it's just like, you'll probably spend a lifetime working on it and never solve it entirely. But you, I hopefully are just making progress towards getting better and better and making more positive impact.
But what I say to clients normally is that if you can start with an idea of what it is, and it then helps you obviously to start thinking about how you're going to be able to measure that. And then the data is the challenge, right? But if you don't set up the right questions, and that is, you know, if anyone that is an expert on theory of change, and as you get more involved in it, as you go through the process, you know, one of the parts is, which I love, which is like asking the right questions. Are you asking the right questions, you know, to be able to then come up with the data? Because if you went set up whatever firm you set up, and then you go 2-3 years down the road, and then you want to show your impact, you cannot go back to get the data, right? So,
100%. Love it. That's exactly right. They're asking the right questions. This is a big part of it.
Yeah, and it takes time. It takes time. And the other thing, I would recommend anyone that's thinking about it is that, again, just don't go too deep into the hole. Just, you know, and some of the best investors I have interviewed always talk about, from their side and from the investee perspective, that you have to just limit it to at least a few variables or KPIs, right? 1, 2, 3 max, because if not, it can become
very, very expensive
and it deviates from delivering the business. But
yeah, I think I think that's the challenge, is finding the balance between going deep enough and not going too deep in the rabbit hole. And what I always say to anybody who's kind of going down this route of, I want my investments to have a more, you know, be more sustainable or have a positive impact, is very first thing I say is, okay, we can go down this road, and we will, but you can't make perfect the enemy of the good. Your portfolio, as we start to unpack this, you'll find more and more wrong with it that you're unhappy with, and we won't be able to fix it all. So let's make improvements and let's get better and better over time, but don't let that but that it's not going to be perfect right away, don't let that stop you from taking the first step anyway.
So if you know, talking about not stopping you, so if we talk about the future, and obviously I think there is, talking about the future, I talk about the future sustainable impact investing, how we scale it. Obviously there's a few angles I could ask you here, because it's one which is around, you know, you mentioned how do we make the service more diverse. You know, there's one around the challenges of the fiduciary duty and, you know, servicing the big numbers, the pensions, versus servicing, you know, the big numbers of amount of people that need service and advice. So I don't know, let me put it out there, pick one. where are we going, and what can help us kind of grow sustainable impact investing in any of these areas? Obviously you have a specific one, but
yeah, I mean, let me bring up one I haven't mentioned already, which is and I'm passionate about, and actually thinking about working, starting to try to tackle this more formally. But financial advisors are a big bottleneck in this process. The average financial advisor, and this is true in the UK and in the US and in Canada. The UK is, I think, probably there's nowhere better in the world, my guess, but still has a lot of room for improvement. Is that advisors are not very familiar with ESG investing and impact investing. And if they're not, the vast majority of high net worth individuals, so where, you know, most of the wealth is concentrated, invest through an advisor. And if their advisor is not on board and doesn't understand this stuff and isn't working with their clients to help them, then it's going to move a lot. You know, the assets are going to move a lot slower than they otherwise would, because a lot of, you know, what's happening right now is advisors are responding if and when clients who have large portfolios demand it, and it's very important to them. And they say, like, listen, if you're not going to help me, I'll go somewhere else where they can. And then advisors, you know, begrudgingly, oh, okay, I got to learn about this stuff. I got to help this client. It's a big client. I care a lot about this individual not leaving, or they're getting it, you know, from a few clients. But if that's not happening, they're not bringing it up in conversations. And think about all the people who just, you know, aren't aware of it yet, who would, if their advisor spoke to them about it, and their advisor probably has hundreds of clients who have, you know, large portfolios, and they could be talking to them about this. So we need to have advisors starting to get around their head around this. And part of the problem is, you know, you've got an older advisor who has spent their whole career doing things one way that doesn't include sustainable investing. And then you say, hey, you've got to learn about this whole new field and all these new investment opportunities and all that. It feels a little like, oh, you know, I've set things up the way that I wanted over my whole career. I'm in the final stretch now, the last 5 years of my career. I want to be out on the golf course and enjoying, you know, some of the free time, because this is all a well-oiled machine now, my practice. And now you're telling me to do something different and new. It's understandably a little, oh man, really? And so we have to figure out a way to help advisors get around that curve and start helping their clients with it. And if we can do that, I think we'll unlock a lot more capital for positive impact. Mm.
Yes. And that was brought up, I think, a couple of times when we talked to some other investors which work with financial advisors. And is here in the UK specifically, they've been kind of fighting back, right? And there is also another part to what you mentioned, which is they just, sometimes it's hard to understand, right? And it's, you have to, aside from learning, and people don't like talking about something they don't know about.
That's right. 100%.
And obviously, and as it wasn't as well defined maybe a couple of years ago, not long ago, maybe now it's getting better defined. And, you know, hopefully, again, every financial advisor is listening to this episode, and they'll learn a little bit more and then can have, you know, resources to pick up on. Maybe that's a good question as well. So any suggestions and any financial advisors that want to, I don't want to ask it this way, but what is the quickest way? You know, what is the, is that, I think you were doing one certification, which is, I read it, it was like one on impact. Is it that one, yeah, or is it the CFA sustainability one? Or, you know, there are, I can see so many good universities coming up with so many courses as well online now, but obviously it becomes this problem, which I highlighted. I just wrote a short guide recently, which is, you know, the first problem why people are struggling and not having, creating profit and impact, is because of the overwhelm of information now. It's always been like that, but it's getting pretty heavy on our field, right?
It is. Yeah, it's getting worse because the industry is maturing. There's more terms, more organizations and certifications. So to answer your question, I think this probably the CFA's ESG certification is probably a really great place for advisors. It deals with like the, really the public markets type of ESG investing, which is more on the sustainable side rather than the impact investing, which tends to happen more in the private markets. So I would say that's a great place. The one that I'm working towards, the Certified Professional Impact Analyst, CPIA, is more for the kind of private market side and more kind of focused on in a developing world context. Right. It uses some strategies like cost benefit analysis and things like that to really figure out, like, for every dollar I'm spending, what benefit is that provide? Is spending and or investing, is that providing? It's really trying to put a dollar value on the translate your impact into dollar value so that you can make comparisons between, hey, what's the impact of this investment I made into health versus education? And how do I compare those, the cost benefit of the dollars I put towards those different, very different positive impacts. So that's an interesting course though, if people are curious and anybody's listening who has an interest in that, because it's not particularly well known. It's out of a university here in Canada called Queen's University. So if you Google CPIA and Queen's, and you'll find a website.
We'll put a link.
Yeah.
And this brings me to the next questions, which basically, you know, is about David O'Leary, right? So about you. So how did you end up, you know, thinking and doing all of this? You know, for those kind of, I mentioned a brief about your background and your kind of professional side, but you've been doing this for, you know, over 20 years. You know, very briefly, so I picked up a couple of things on your life story, you know, that you actually moved to South Africa, which I mentioned before. You know, you worked with like large organizations. Sorry, I don't mean to tell the story for you, but
no.
It's fascinating to see, you know, all the different stages. Which, you know, as I was thinking about our conversation, brings me to the point about you have had a real evolution and transition, you know, which is a lot of people reach out to me to ask me, okay, how do I get into this? How do I do this? You know, and I give, you know, some tips all over the place, to be honest. And I also, obviously, some people may have heard already, but I just launched a program called Impact Leaders just to help some more people and try scale it, you know, because you touched on something that I talk about more and more now, which is I realized, you know, that we only the same with financial. So this is happens in all walks of life, all areas, right? So only the 1% of the 1% I've been saying recently, you know, get the benefit and the best service, the best knowledge, you know, and we need to share more of that, call it, you know, financial planning, financial education, financial intelligence, financial inclusion. In our case, is just helping people understand how can they, you know, unlock themselves, you know, to create more profit and impact. But the reason why I mentioned that is because when I was reading your story, it just came to my mind. The transition, you have had this amazing transition. So sorry, let me stop there.
I know that's. I'd love to hear more about that after the podcast sometime. Let's connect. I'd love to hear more about your impact leaders thing. That's really great because I also have a lot of people who'll ask me about how to do. You know, they want to, you know, transition and change and don't know how to go about doing it. I mean, for me, I'll describe it. But the way I think of it is, you know, I kind of accidentally fell down a hill and then, you know, just rolled down and it was messy and wasn't controlled and wasn't super intentional or thoughtful from the start. But I've picked up kind of momentum and steam. And as you're rolling down the hill, you're starting to get your bearings. And now it's more of a focused, you know, choice to continue that. But I had met, you know, I grew up in Toronto and I was very indoctrinated in free market capitalism through the CFA program. And I did a very traditional finance MBA at University of Toronto. And so very much was steeped in this idea that you invest to make a profit. And that's the only thing you should be focused on, Milton Friedman style. And I met my wife in 2009. And she came from a long line of humanitarian workers. Her grandparents on both sides spent their entire lives in Ethiopia. And so her parents had grown up in Ethiopia they were missionaries. And then Her parents went into international development. And so my wife grew up in actually Kenya for a bit and then Ethiopia in the 1980s during the famine. And so when I met her and her family, it was just eye-opening. I had spent no time thinking about what else, you know, other people and trying to help. And her family for multiple generations had devoted their entire lives to it. That's a pretty profound.
How did you meet? Just curious now.
Oh, online.
Oh.
Yeah, there's a I don't even know if it exists anymore, called eHarmony, which is
I think
site.
It must be. What's that? It used to be quoted as the best algorithm, right? So
yeah, that's
interesting.
That
and the reason why I say is because it's two worlds colliding, right?
Yeah, that's right. We would never have met otherwise. We had no common friends, we didn't hang in the same social circles. And so that was really profound. And what it did, it has caused me to stop and think like, oh, what, this is an interesting difference. And so I'm in love with her and I am interested to know more about it. I took a sabbatical from my job at the time. I was working at Morningstar, which is a large data and analytics company. And I took a sabbatical and spent a couple months in Sierra Leone volunteering through a large NGO that my wife works for and her mom had worked for. And I spent some time around their work in microfinance. And I was just, I didn't know what I was doing. It felt like microfinance at the time. I didn't even know what impact investing was. And microfinance felt like the closest thing I could find to my background in investments. And I went and spent time there. And it was, this sounds like a bad cliche because, the world is littered with stories of white guys going to Africa and then talking about how changed they were from the whole experience. But it was very profound. I don't know how you go to an environment like Sierra Leone, which is, at the time I went was not even a decade removed from a very long, protracted, ugly civil war. And how you leave that unchanged from it. So it was very profound. And I ended up coming back from that, not quitting my job, but I asked Morningstar to relocate me to our South Africa office. We wanted to live closer to where my wife was doing a lot of work in West Africa. And they were good about it. They were great. They were very supportive. And so I essentially started doing my same job, but for the South African market. And it gave us a lot of opportunity to travel sub-Saharan Africa. We were supporting just personally with some money we'd raised through our wedding, a bunch of community-based organizations throughout sub-Saharan Africa that our parents had known, and got to go visit them, see the work that they were doing. That's where I first started to learn about in the nonprofit world, they'll use a term called log frame. So logical framework, very similar to theory of change. And that's where I started learning about log frames and impact measurement and reporting and things like that. And so I just, went from place to place, saw the layers of poverty through Africa and the different ways organizations were trying to solve them and track that progress. And, then continued to compound. I started to learn more about it, read more and travel more, and just the momentum continued.
That's a different hill. That's a different hill you went down. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I stumbled down it rather than, I didn't know at the time that it was going to be this big, that my life, that I would change my job, my profession, and devote all my time and energy this way. I became more and more passionate about it as I went.
Fascinating. And then you moved back to Canada.
Yeah, we ended up spending about 4 years in South Africa, moved back to Canada. And I moved back specifically to start, go down this road of helping investors align their wealth with their values more, whether that's through philanthropy, impact investing, responsible investing.
Mm-hmm. And you did also, because I think I picked up, so in between those, you also were doing pension, you were working with the pension manager, or did I? Yeah.
So I spent when I came back from South Africa, I'd left Morningstar. I came back to start a financial advisory practice before Kind Wealth, which was with two buddies I grew up with called Eden Valley Partners. And we were doing more traditional financial advisory for older clients, higher net worth. But I was getting more and more interested in the responsible side of it, getting access to, helping clients that don't have as much wealth. Yeah. Younger clients, and my partners weren't as aligned with that. And so I left, started Kind Wealth. At the time I started Kind Wealth, though, just as I was starting it, I was approached by the World Vision, which is the NGO that my wife mm-hmm. works for and I had volunteered with in Sierra Leone. And they were starting an impact investing group. And I had gotten to know the organization pretty well. And uh, they they wanted somebody with an investment background. They had, you know, a whole bunch of folks with international development experience and education working on impact investing and starting to get the ball rolling. And they wanted to bring in a complementary kind of background. And so I ended up taking that job just as I was getting Kind Wealth off the ground, and spent about 3 years at World Vision helping them figure out how to raise investment capital and then use that investment capital to make a positive impact. And World Vision's mission is really around helping the most vulnerable children. So they do a lot of work around education, nutrition, policy and advocacy work, kind of like across the board. They have a wide sectoral footprint, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And I did that work for 3 years. That wound down last year, and I've been back on Kind Wealth full time since then.
Yeah. Well, when I put the link to World Vision as well, amazing. The numbers, if you just look at the website, the stories, it's just,
World Vision's a fascinating, I won't go down this rabbit hole, it's a really fascinating organization with an interesting approach.
And it's wonderful, you know, to see, and it happens to see, because I think it was really nice, you know, I read that, a bit of that story that you have, I had the benefit to look at, and then when you see, it's so nice. I don't know, like, you know, the one that I've read, your more casual kind of a story, is that somewhere? Is that on your website?
Yeah. I think it's on on the Kind Wealth website. So kindwealth.ca, and then there's an About Us section, and you can kind of read my bio. Mm-hmm. I believe
that
I have
you have
there.
A website a personal website or?
Oh, I'm sorry. I do. Yeah. So yeah, that's right. So davidoleary.ca.
That's brilliant.
All one word, no apostrophe, yeah. davidoleary.ca.
Perfect. Perfect. So I highly recommend people to go and check it out. So, and as we come to the end, let me spoil maybe the surprise that you learn. But this is some of the like hidden cool secrets, right? But you were competitive boxers in Canada and South Africa. If you ever see the pictures and you watch the video, you know, you won't believe it, because he still has a pretty good nose, as from what I can see. So either he was like really, really good boxer and, you know, punch people, or he didn't really, you know, fight with anyone that could touch him.
No, maybe I hide it well. I have a deviated septum from boxing. I had my nose busted up quite a few times, lots of black eyes. Thankfully, hopefully no long-term damage. it was a lot of fun. I enjoy it. I don't recommend it as a sport. I wouldn't necessarily encourage my kids to get into it, but I kind of grew up watching it with my dad on TV, and his dad was a boxer, and so it kind of just ran in my blood. I really enjoy it, but it's maybe not the healthiest sport.
One of my daughters, she just kind of watch it. She's like, she just says like, "Dad, I can't."
I completely understand that. It's when you look at it, it's pretty barbaric.
Let's not even talk about USC and others, right? But I was going to say that phrase because somebody just said it to me in one of my business groups, you know, which is like, everyone has a plan until you get punched in the face. I think that's Mike Tyson's phrase, right?
And
it really applies. It really applies to life. So as we are coming to the last part, so, you know, obviously you have seen, and I meant to ask you actually, so you mentioned the missionary work that your parents-in-laws or no, your wife's grandparents.
Yeah, you know? my wife's parents. Yeah.
Yeah. So they went from Canada as well to Africa.
In her mom's parents, they both were on both sides of her family were in. So her mom's parents and her dad's parents were both in Ethiopia, and her parents met actually in boarding school in Ethiopia. Wow. So their parents actually knew each other, and her mom's parents came from Canada, and her dad's were in the U.S. I think Ohio and somewhere in the kind of deep. Her dad's mom was in the South somewhere, but I read her grandmother on her dad's side, her story, a journal of that experience. And she left a small town very young, feeling called by God to kind of go do this work, and ended up having to leave her family who didn't support it. And, you know, went to Chicago to the missionary headquarters and went on an elevator for the first time in her life. Had never been in a building that had an elevator, and, you know, went to go get her kind of deployment instructions and was sent off ultimately to first to Sudan and then to Ethiopia, and arrive in Ethiopia and everything, you pack it up onto a mule and you head west. And we're going to find a remote village that needs help. And then you unpack and we got to build a school and a hospital and you have no maps. They've never been there before. She's never left her small town. I mean, it's just that if I flew to, even with all the technology we have and I can research, I'd be nervous about going into a small village in rural, sub-Saharan Africa somewhere that I'd never been. And I have all the benefits of modern technology. She had none of that. It's really amazing.
Fascinating, right? And that's all to fulfill God's call, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, from everything I've read about it and seen, it was, 100%. It's, they're feeling called by God to go, in their case, it's, for missionaries, it's spreading the word of God, but it's also development work. Yes, I mean, they're building schools and hospitals. And so a lot of, talk happens around the ills and the evils that created it in the name of religion. And I think those things are true, but what often doesn't get talked about is all the good that's been done also in the name of religion. And I've, just been able to see some of that, first and second hand through my wife's work. And
beautiful.
And World Vision has a very strong faith-based aspect to the work that they do. They don't proselytize, but they do the faith and the values of Christianity underpin their work and why they're out trying to improve lives.
Yeah, fascinating.
It's a very complex
and touching, right? Because if anything, and I do tell people, but maybe in the podcast I haven't said it, out loud. But I'm a newborn Christian, right? As of like 2.5 years ago, I had a moment and situations, etc. And I understand now what it means, which I couldn't understand before. To be touched by God and then to have a purpose and a mission that is way beyond you so that's why I when you mention it, I just thought, okay, let me just hear it, because most people that have never experienced it never understand, and it's very hard to understand. And this is nothing to do with religion, by the way. And I've learned this through, actually, one time I was talking to John Elkington for the podcast, and he said, let me separate religion from spirituality. Think, if I had to say, maybe Christianity sits in the middle, but just when you say that, she just did that, and then the family didn't support, etc. It's very hard, right? Very hard to understand. But which brings me to the last question before the last, which is, as you see the examples, like, this lady and your wife and, people you have seen, across the world, what do you think makes an impact leader?
I think overwhelmingly it's somebody driven by that purpose and that deep empathy and care for others. And whether that's, your cause is environmental or it's social. I think this distinction between environment and social is a kind of a manufactured distinction. I think these things are deeply intertwined, right? Mm-hmm. None of us survive if the climate change destroys the planet. Mm-hmm. And if we degrade our environment, it has social impacts on all of us. And so I think ultimately what it comes down to is a deep care and concern for people and planet. And because this work is so hard, and we've got such a long way to go, and there's so many hurdles and obstacles along the way. And to be honest with you, in our lifetimes, we're not going to solve a lot of these problems. We're going to, go to our graves without having probably seen the type, the full change that we want to see. But we do it anyway because you care so much about it, and you go that hard path, and because, and that's the only thing that's going to sustain you. If you're there for any other reason, like, some sort of short-term, like people say nice things about you, or you're going to make some money or whatever it is, like those things, there are easier ways to do those things. And so what sustains you over the long term, the true impact leader who's committed to it, is that you feel that burning commitment to it, that's what you're here to do, because that's what will sustain you through the years and years of hard work that are ahead.
Burning commitment.
Yeah.
And the last ones is, what is your kind of call to action, to listeners? What would you ask them or like them to do?
Well, so one will be selfish and the other will be none. So take a look at the, if you're listening to this podcast, I host a very similar podcast. That's why one of the reasons we connected, called the Impact Investing Podcast. And I'm, shout out to my listeners as well that they should check out the Impact Leaders Podcast, because we have not a lot of overlap in guests, actually. I don't know if we've had any overlap.
We had one.
A very similar. Who is the one we have in common?
The last one you had, Andrew Perry.
Oh, right. Great. Okay. Yeah. Andrew was great.
I love Andrew. I love Andrew.
Because he's from the UK. Yeah. So I view them very much as like, if you want like just an extra set of interviews and guests, because we have a very similar structure to the conversations. So check it. There's a way to double our library.
Brilliant.
And then the unselfish one is everyone should, I would love to get to the place where every investor and all of us, even those of us who don't have big portfolios, have investments, like, or most of us do. If you've got a job and you've got a pension, for instance, you probably have some sort of, retirement savings plan through your employer where you're purchasing a mutual fund or exchange traded fund or something like that. In South Africa, other parts of the world, we might call it a unit trust. Yeah. But you've got these investments, and those investments are going into stocks and bonds and businesses that may not be operating very sustainably. And so take an interest in like, where are your investment dollars? Either the ones that you've decided where they go through your bank or advisor or through your work. And we do this automatically for like our spending choices. We understand, I think more and more people are aware that, where I spend my dollars is a vote for the types of companies and organizations I want to support. I want us to think about our investments that way. And so if you, for instance, have an employer and you've got a pension or you've got savings going into that, ask them about whether the investments through your pension are being invested responsibly and what choices you have. And your HR department is probably where you'll go to ask that question. You'll start. That person that you speak to will probably have no idea, but they'll then go to the pension provider, the administrator of that, and start asking those questions. And what we need is more and more employees to care about this, ask about it, because it sends the message. Yeah. And there's a lot of money tied up in pension assets that could be invested more responsibly. And that's something all of us could do. It takes very little effort and sends a very strong message.
Fantastic. I'll say it depends, obviously, who is your provider. But I have one of my funds. They send this pack, and then you get the access to the reports online. Obviously, the pack has gone much smaller, and it's just a bit of a leaflet now asking you to go and watch it online. And you get a lot more information, on what they're doing, how they're doing it already, so you can see. But this is one of the biggest financial services firms' pension, right? So obviously they have.
And if it's a UK one, it's probably a global leader.
They have the resources, right? Which is another story, right? So manage your expectations, but ask the questions. I would say definitely.
Yeah, and if you're working with a financial advisor, ask them. Expect that they are going to expect them to help you with that.
And then
those are two big, things you can do to send a message.
And then I was just going to say as well, people go to the website at thecanwealth.ca and you can join the club because David and the team, they do education, they do events. Obviously if you are in the US, our listeners are global, but if you're in the US, it goes maybe more to your time. I think maybe you even have some things on replay as well, right? So people can watch and learn. Yeah. So fantastic. And
to make it easy for people, if they go to impactinvesting.how, H-O-W, Impact Investing, all one word, and then .how, that is a website you can sign up to in a newsletter. You can get the podcast episodes, articles I write, access to the Clubhouse conversation recordings. It's a distribution list for all a bunch of resources that help people, free resources to help people get smarter about impact investing.
Oh, I didn't know that one.
That's
fantastic.
A great one-stop shop.
Fantastic. Because that, and then do you get some contact details there if they want to reach out? Or where's the best way to connect you? Where's the best way?
My contact details are there. And when you sign up to the newsletter, you get an auto email that you can reply to, and that comes directly to me, and I respond to all of those. So. Best way is just sign up at impactinvesting.how and then you can shoot me an email directly.
Fantastic. That's it. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Listen, I really appreciate you having me on. This is a really great conversation. I really liked, I talked about a bunch of things here that I haven't talked about with others before, and I think they're really great questions on like really important issues.
Yeah, I think so. I think so too. I think I really, really enjoy it. But let me just finish it, you know, with our formal kind of close. So which is, you know, again, thank you so much for your time. And I just before I go, I wanted to take the opportunity to invite people to partner with me and Impact Leaders. We want to help and do more to raise awareness and create action. The podcast is what I call it, is a catalytic initiative, you know, to help deliver on our mission to raise awareness, to help transition capital into sustainable and impact investing faster and at scale, as I like it, right? So it has to be faster and scale, you know, with all these challenges and issues that you mentioned today as well, David. So if you want, you can reach out, you know, to us. We're looking for just a couple more founder sponsors for what we're working on. We obviously, I mentioned to you the Impact Leaders program. So we're looking for just effectively invite 7 more Impact Leaders to join the program to, you know, this is the first part of it, or the first cohort, if you would call it. And then by all means, you can go to our website or to Bitly IL Club if you want to register interest for that. Thank you so much. And until our next episode of Impact Leaders, and God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you for watching this video and for listening to the Impact Leaders podcast. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILA & Partners. Please connect with us to work together in the transition of capital into sustainable and impact investing. If you would like to support the podcast more specifically, we will be soon launching the Impact Leaders Private Club, including the Supercast and Patreon subscriptions. Alternatively, you can email us at podcast@ilaandpartners.com to become a sponsor or patron. Thank you.